We're going to pick up this morning where I left off the other day talking about gases. And what I've done is I've drawn this box just to remind us that one way of viewing gases is to view them as a set of particles that are all bouncing inside of a container. And not that we're ever going to use this equation in this class, but for those of you who haven't had physics before, I made a mention of kinetic energy the other day. And if you have an object that's traveling at a certain speed, there is an equation that we can use to calculate what that kinetic energy would be. So I just wanted to have shown that equation once. So in this equation, m stands for the mass of the object, v stands for velocity or speed. So 1/2 mv² gives us the kinetic energy. And the reason I'm bringing this up is kinetic energy is related to temperature. Temperature is a measure of the average kinetic energy in a system. And so what that means is as something increases in temperature, the molecules in that sample are increasing in kinetic energy. So if we take that idea that temperature is related to kinetic energy, that we have a collection of gas molecules that are bouncing around inside of this container, and then also the idea that pressure is related to the fact that these molecules are going to be bumping into the side of the container, then we can use that picture to come up with several different gas laws. So if you look at the end of chapter 6, there's a discussion of some individual gas laws that lead up to what's known as the ideal gas law. So I'm not as concerned that you can name the individual gas laws. I'm more concerned that you can understand the logic behind where they come from. So the only equation that I might quote by name that you need to know is the ideal gas law itself, which, depending on how much time it takes me to describe these examples, we might not quite get to today, but that's the goal, to get up to the ideal gas law. Now, there's two different situations I want to describe. What happens if we have gases in a flexible container, and what happens if we have gases in a container that can't move at all? And so the two examples I'm going to use are a balloon and a metal can. Now, if you have had physics before, if you had any more advanced science classes at all, these are going to be very simplified examples. So yes, if you have a balloon, in real life, there's some stretch to that material that might fight against the action of a gas. So we're going to kind of ignore that. And then for a metal can, yes, if you put enough pressure inside a metal can, eventually that metal can will fail and it will burst open and deform. But we're just going to imagine then these examples that the metal can is unbreakable, it's indestructible. So let's start out with an example that, let's say that we have a sample that's in a balloon. So a real life example would be if you have a balloon that you fill up at regular room temperature, which would be about 25 degrees Celsius, and you were to put it into a freezer or refrigerator. Maybe if you all were kids, you had maybe tried that before. So does anybody know what's going to happen? Maybe you hadn't tried it before. So let's see if we can figure that out logically based on this description of what gases are. First of all, why would a balloon reach a certain size depending on what pressure you fill it up at? Well, it's a battle between the gas molecules on the inside of that balloon and on the outside. So if you fill it up at regular atmospheric pressure, regular room temperature, that size it's going to reach is where the pressure inside and outside the balloon are equal to each other. So based on this description of kinetic energy, what's going to happen then when we put the balloon into a refrigerator? It is going to shrink. Because if you think of it this way, temperature, I had said earlier, is related to kinetic energy. So if you're putting the balloon into an environment that has a lower temperature, that means the molecules are going to slow down. And then that means that there's not going to be as much motion on the inside of the balloon. The molecules aren't going to be hitting the insides of the balloon with as much force. So if we imagine that inside and outside a refrigerator, the pressure is the same, then that means pressure's not changing during this whole process. So the outside pressure is still forcing in on the balloon with the same amount. But on the inside, the molecules aren't traveling as fast, so they're not able to fight this pressure as much, and so the balloon is going to be able to shrink. So we can call this case number one. That if we take a balloon, fill it at room temperature, and put it in a fridge or a freezer, its volume is going to shrink as long as the pressure stays the same. So let me write out that case. Imagine a balloon is filled at regular atmospheric pressure. And I'll define what that means in just a little while. And let's say that it's at what standard room temperature, which is called 25 degrees Celsius. The size the balloon will have depends on when the inside and outside pressures are equal to each other. Which again is going to explain why it changes as temperature changes. So if the balloon is then put into a refrigerator at the same pressure, I'll say the same external pressure, meaning outside the balloon, the pressure is the same. Then the average energy of the molecules inside the balloon is going to drop because of the decrease in temperature. So this means that the molecules are not colliding with as much force on the interior of the balloon. So the volume will shrink, the balloon will shrink, or I guess I could say the volume will decrease until the pressure inside and outside are equal again. And it turns out there is a mathematical relationship, what's known as a linear relationship. So linear means that if you double one of these things, you'll double the other. If you double the temperature, then if the pressure is held the same, you end up doubling the volume. So the way that you could write that is, there's two different ways, and the text does both of these. One of these uses what's known as a proportionality symbol. So this alpha, the way it's written here, means is proportional to. So volume is proportional to temperature. Temperature goes up, volume goes up accordingly. Temperature go down, then the volume is going to go down. The other way to write that is in equation form. So we could say that volume is equal to temperature multiplied by some kind of constant. So the only reason I'm showing this first version of the expression is because it is shown in the text as well. Thanks. And so, and if you've never seen this symbol before, then I just wanted to explain that that symbol means there's proportionality. So it's linearly, directly proportional to. And to turn that into equation form, what we do is we stick in a constant. So there's some kind of conversion that would go on to go from temperature to volume. So I never remember these individual laws myself, since I don't force students to learn the names, but the text does indicate that this is known as Charles' Law. So again, when you're reading through the text, you'll see that heading, but you don't need to memorize the name. You just need to understand what's going on in the situation that I described. So did anybody have any questions about this first case that we've talked about? Okay, so this was a case where we had a balloon that was flexible. So case number two is going to be if we have a rigid metal can. So I know the show has been off the air for a little while now, but some of you might have heard of the Mythbusters before. Okay. Which, if you have heard of them, I had the chance to meet them because I was actually the host of a show that they did here at the Flint Center once. They were organizing the program, and they were calling around in the district to figure out, well, who could lead this program? And someone somehow knew who I was. They said, well, there's this chemistry instructor. Maybe he would want to do it, which was an interesting event because you meet them, and in real life, they're a little different than they seem on TV. Besides that, you go out on this program, and these people in science land are like rock stars. So you walk out on stage, and there's 2,000 people in the audience ready to see them. So I thought, I better not mess this one up. But if you have seen any of the Mythbusters episodes, they did something related to exactly what I'm about to describe here. Which is, imagine that you filled up a metal can and you had steam, which you could do that by taking water and boiling it inside the can. And then imagine that you put a lid, sealed off that can, and then dumped the whole metal can in a bucket of cold water. Of course, a minute ago I said we were going to pretend that these metal cans are indestructible, but in real life, if you had like a gas can, one of the rectangular kind that you did this with, what would happen is the can would suddenly get crushed. And I'll describe why in just a moment. So the reason I mention the Mythbusters is they didn't do that just with a little metal can. They did it with one of these huge oil barrel drums. And they found that the same thing happened to it. And then they tried to take a big old tanker car, a railway car that holds liquids, and they tried to do the same thing to the whole darn railway car. Which, if you want to see the episode, I won't say how that ends up turning out, but it all is related just to pressure. So let me explain what happens in this can example. So in this case, we have a rigid metal can that you fill up with gas at a certain temperature. So imagine a metal can is filled with a gas at, let's say it's a high temperature, 80 degrees Celsius at regular atmospheric pressure, which I still need to define that in a moment. The can is then placed in a refrigerator. Now, if this really was an indestructible metal can, that means that the volume is not able to change. So if you put it in the fridge, what's going to happen? It's the pressure that's going to change now. If the volume, so back in the balloon case, the reason that the balloon changes volume is it's dependent on pressure, which for those of you who hadn't had physics, remember that pressure is force divided by area. So if you have a balloon that's got a certain surface area on the inside, then if for a moment the pressure drops because the molecules are moving more slowly, well, if that balloon shrinks, that decreases the amount of surface area, and that brings the pressure back up again. So that's why in the balloon case, the volume changes so that the pressure on the inside and the outside end up being equal. But in this case, we've got a metal can that theoretically can't change volume. So if the temperature drops and the motion of the molecules drop, there's no way the can can adjust to compensate for that change in the motion of the molecules. So what ends up happening is the pressure on the inside drops. Now let me write that out before I make any further comment. So due to the drop in temperature, the molecules on the inside of the can will move more slowly. If the can is unable to change shape, which is what we're assuming, this means the pressure inside the can will drop, since the molecules won't be hitting the inside of the can with as much force. Now, in real life, if we did this demonstration with a somewhat flimsy metal gas can, then that's a can where if you had enough difference in pressure on the inside and outside, the can is not able to withstand it. So earlier I was describing that if we heated up water, boiled it inside that can, then sealed it off, and then we dunked it in cold water, well, the pressure in the inside the can suddenly drops. But the outside atmospheric pressure doesn't change. So what happens is literally the outside pressure crushes the can, because by doing it, it then reduces the inside surface area. So it ends up just like the balloon case, where the pressure tries to become equilibrated inside and out. For our example, if we say the can can't change shape, then it's going to change its pressure instead. And that ends up being linearly proportional, the pressure and the temperature, just like volume and temperature were. So, in other words, we could write this relationship two different ways, that pressure is directly related to temperature. Maybe some of you have experienced the opposite. You've used pressure cookers before. And if you've ever had an accident with a pressure cooker and ended up with your meal all over the ceiling, you know what happens. You take a closed system, you heat it up too much, the pressure increases. So pressure, temperature goes up, pressure goes up. Temperature go down, pressure goes down. So again, we can convert that into equation form by using a constant. So there's some kind of relationship between pressure and temperature. So now we got two relationships going on, volume and temperature, pressure and temperature. Well, what if we were to look at pressure and volume? what the relationship is there. And the way we could do that, we could imagine a couple different cases. One example, just to mention it quickly, is a balloon. We all have the idea that if you take a balloon and squish it, it's going to pop. Well, why is that? Well, because, again, if you are changing its shape, if you're restricting its size, then you're decreasing surface area, but the temperature hadn't changed, so the molecules on the inside are still bouncing around with as much force, but now if they don't have as much area, then that means an increased pressure. So in that example, at some point you reach the point where the material, the balloon, can't handle the pressure, and that's why it fails. Another example that I'll use is imagine that we have a piston. We have some kind of metal cylinder. And if we had a piston that could move back and forth and adjust its size compared to a sample of gas that was trapped inside that piston. Well, you can imagine that as you try to squeeze that air together, you'll reach a point where, as humans, we can't physically squeeze it any further. Why? Again, for the same reason. As the volume contracts, that surface area is shrinking, and so the pressure goes up. So I'll write this example out as case number 3, talking about a piston. Imagine a sample of gas. Is placed inside a piston at regular atmospheric pressure. At regular room temperature, so at 25 degrees Celsius. If the piston is then compressed, aside from lowering volume, it also reduces the surface area that the gas molecules collide with. This will cause the pressure inside the piston to increase. So there's a couple of different ways we can express this idea. One is to say that as the pressure increases, the volume decreases. And so now this is what's known as an inverse relationship. One goes up, the other goes down. The other way you could write that mathematically is to say that pressure times volume is equal to some constant. And again, that would mean that if one of these, pressure or volume, goes up, if you're going to maintain that constant, the other one has to go down. So now we have 3 different gas laws, and there's one more that hopefully makes some obvious sense, which is this. The more gas you have, the higher the pressure it'll be at, or the higher the volume it'll be at. So in other words, if you are filling a tank up with 1 mole of a gas, that tank will get up to a certain pressure. If you put 2 moles of the gas in, it'll be double the amount of pressure. So that means the number of moles of gas that you have is somehow involved as well. So when you put all of these things together, you come up with one overall equation, which is this. PV equals nRT. So this maintains that volume is directly related to temperature, that pressure is directly related to temperature, that pressure and volume are inverses of each other. Now, you might remember N, that's our variable for moles. And so, number of moles of gas is related to volume or to pressure, the way I just described. The last thing that goes in this equation is a fudge factor that makes the equation equal. That's that constant that lets the two halves of the equation be equal to each other. So because for many of you, this is the first time you've seen this equation, let me write out what all the variables are. So we have pressure, volume, which is V. We have the number of moles, N. We have what's known as the gas constant. That's R, and then we have T, which is temperature. Now, one important thing is that the temperature is always, no matter what, it's always in Kelvin. Why? Because Kelvin is what's known as an absolute scale. There is a zero that is the lowest number on the scale. If we were to take the Celsius scale and try to do some calculation with gases, it wouldn't match the results. Because if you can imagine 0 degrees Celsius, if you have zero as temperature, that means the gas shouldn't occupy any volume or shouldn't have any pressure, which we know in real life that's not true. So all of the calculations that we might end up doing, everything always has to be done in terms of Kelvin. Now, for volume, that's usually the standard units of liters. Moles, that's a standard number as well. So then the only thing that's a question mark is pressure, which let me just look at your text really quickly to see which pressure units it introduces. Okay, so it does introduce a couple of different units, so let me talk about them. And I'll try to do the quick explanation of where some of these units come from. So one of the more confusing units that's used for pressure is what's known as a millimeter of mercury. Now, millimeter, that's a measure of length. So how is it that length somehow ends up related to pressure? Well, here's the idea. If you had some kind of container that was under total vacuum, and you stuck that container in a pool of mercury, it'll pull that mercury up a certain distance inside the tube. And it turns out it doesn't matter what the shape of that tube is, which, if we really cared, I could use math to explain it. But I'm trying to skim through this part a little quickly. So I'll just say that the size of the container doesn't matter. But depending on the outside pressure, we could look at the length of this tube of liquid, and that would be equivalent to the pressure on the outside of this whole system. And so we have a standard unit of measure called an atmosphere. Which is abbreviated ATM. And I don't know how the standard was established, but the standard is that that's equal to 760 millimeters of mercury. So in other words, if you're at this standard atmospheric pressure and you use one of these old-style barometers, it's called, that column of mercury on the inside would be 760 millimeters tall. Now, there is a metric unit as well, which is called a pascal, abbreviated PA. And it comes from other metric units. So again, I know that you might not have had physics, but if pressure is force over area, the metric unit for force is something called a newton. An area, we measure that in meters. So it ends up being 1 newton over meters squared. Force over area. This unit we probably won't use much, so I'm just mentioning it. What we will probably use is atmospheres and millimeters of mercury. Of course, if we had millimeters, we could also convert that into inches. So sometimes on weather stations, they'll report pressures in terms of inches of mercury. So it doesn't matter which unit you use for pressure as long as you're consistent. But which unit of pressure you use will determine the value of R. So I'm not going to make you memorize the value of R, but the common way to do it is to do it in terms of atmospheres. So R has a value of 0.08206 if you're using liters, atmospheres, and you have to use Kelvin, and moles. So it has a complex set of units with it, but that's because if you stick it into the equation to make all the units cancel out, that's why R has the set of units that it does. So I didn't put the title in here, but this is the ideal gas law that I'm talking about. Now, to connect this, what I started talking about last lecture, I started talking about what an ideal gas is. And now that we've talked a little bit more about gases, it might make more sense the way I describe this ideal gas. Because, again, if you're imagining that gas particles are bouncing around on the inside of a container, then if something's interfering with that, that might interfere with the pressure that that gas is going to exert on the container. And so one of the restrictions of an ideal gas is we assume that there aren't any intermolecular forces. Another thing that we assume is that gas molecules don't occupy any volume themselves because it would subtract from the volume of the container that they're bouncing around in. And the last restriction on ideal gases is that they don't lose any energy if they end up colliding with the container. Because if they did, they would affect temperature. So if we make those three assumptions about gases, then all gases obey according to this equation, which does work out in many real-life cases. Your text doesn't go into it because it's beyond the scope of this course, but there are what are known as real gas laws, where we do make adjustments for the fact that molecules do really occupy some volume. We make some adjustments for the fact that there are intermolecular forces. But we won't be working any of those problems in here. So now, what kinds of problems will we be working? Well, if we know the value of R, and we know these other variables, we can figure out, for example, if I give you a certain number of moles of gas, we could come up with how much space that gas is going to occupy. So one type of problem is to simply solve for this equation PV equals nRT. So to just write out an example, imagine a 5-liter container is filled with half a mole of nitrogen gas at 20 degrees Celsius. We could ask, what will be the pressure inside the container? So if we look at PV equals nRT and we look at the problem, we're told volume, we're told moles, we're told temperature. The only thing we're not told is pressure. And remember that R is a constant. So if we need to solve for pressure, we could rewrite this equation. If we divided both sides by V, we get pressure is equal to nRT over V. And so we can just substitute what we've got. We've got 0.5 moles. We have R, which again, I'll give you that value on a quiz or an exam. So it's 0.08206 liter atmosphere per Kelvin mole. Temperature. I gave you the temperature in Celsius. So the one thing that I said earlier that you got to remember in these problems is even though in real life it's more convenient often to use Celsius, for the gas laws, it's always got to be in Kelvin. So if you remember, to get from Celsius to Kelvin, we add 273. So 20 degrees Celsius turns into 293 Kelvin. And then we need to divide by volume, which is 5 liters. So if we multiply all that out, 0.5 moles times 0.08206, the constant, times 293, the temperature, divided by 5, the volume, that equals to 2.4 atmospheres. So it's a fairly direct problem if you just recognize what's being asked for and what information we have already. So that's one flavor of problem. But here's another flavor of problem. Imagine that we filled up the container at a certain temperature, a certain pressure, a certain volume, and then we changed one of those. Exactly like the cases I was describing earlier. If we had a balloon that we were going to put in the fridge, and I told you everything about the balloon before we put it in, how could we figure out what its new volume would be once I changed the temperature? The metal can example. Let's say I filled up to a certain pressure at a certain temperature, and then I changed the temperature. How do we figure out what the new pressure is? So here's the logic we use there. That as long as these examples don't change the amount of gas, the number of moles of gas is not going to change. So I could measure the pressure and volume and temperature at one set of conditions. So I call it P1, V1, T1 to mean one set of conditions. So we could measure that same gas at a completely different set of conditions. So P2, V2, T2. But R is a constant, so it never changes. And if we're talking about the same sample of gas, that means N's not going to change either. So now what I'm going to do is a little mathematical trick. I'm going to put all the stuff that can change on one side of the equation and leave everything that can't change on the other side of the equation. So I get P1 V1 over T1 equals NR. And similarly, P2 V2 over T2 equals NR. Well, if I put those two equations together, because I got two different things equal to the same set of constants, NR. So if I put the two equations together, I get P1 V1 over T1 equals P2 V2 over T2. So this is the expression I could use if I was changing conditions. Now, suppose that it's like the balloon case, where I have the same pressure on the outside before and after putting it on the fridge. Then I can just cancel out pressure from both sides because I end up with the same pressure. So it won't change. What if I was doing something like the metal can, where the volume of the can can't change? Well, then I could drop volume out of this expression, since it's not going to be different before and afterwards. So you can simplify the expression even further. And let's just take one of the examples that's in your text itself. Let me find the problem. So here's an example where it says that a balloon used in an underwater salvage operation is filled to 50 liters at a depth where the pressure is equal to 6.89 atmospheres, and the temperature is 3 degrees Celsius, cold water. That's going to be 280 Kelvin. So I'm already converting to Kelvin because we got to remember all of these problems deal with temperature in Kelvin. It says, imagine that the balloon is brought up to the surface, where at the surface it's closer to standard room temperature, 22 degrees Celsius, which is going to be 3 degrees Celsius is 276 Kelvin, sorry. And then 22 degrees Celsius is 295 Kelvin. There we go. And at the surface, the pressure is closer to normal atmospheric pressure. So the book says 0.988 atmospheres. So it's asking, what would the volume of this balloon be once you brought it back up to the surface? Well, where it started out, its initial set of conditions, that would be P1, V1, T1. So I have first pressure, which is 6.98 atmospheres, the first volume, which is 50 liters, and the first temperature, which is 276 Kelvin. It's asking for what the new volume will be. So I'm going to be solving for V2. P2, it gives me that as well. It's 0.988 atmospheres. And the new temperature is 295 Kelvin. So if I solve for that, let me number crunch really quickly here. Wow, that's a big number, which turns out that's right. We get V2 is equal to 373 liters. It expands a whole bunch because if you're not familiar with that already, as you go underwater, there's so much more pressure because of all the weight of water above you. So pressure decreases as you rise up to the surface. The temperature didn't change that much, so it makes sense that the volume expanded a whole bunch in size. So this is the other type of problem potentially that we're going to work. And then other than coming back and tackling a few small details, we have reached the end of Chapter 6. So next week, we'll be moving on into Chapter 7.